started, I think I'm not sure Steve got it. He gave me this fine print, you know, for an older person. This is really, really difficult to try to reach to introduce our next speaker here. So I'm going to put that aside and get my bigger print, you know, so I can read what about this. But I think, you know, Matt Stiles is no stranger to us, and I think that he's really been a blessing to us as our agencies, and I know that a number of us work with him, each one of our agencies, and I know we work with him and appreciate the information that he's given us. So, but he's a shareholder with Maynard Cooper's out of the Birmingham office, and practices law and employment law, rather, and some of the things that he's just got some unique talents in regards to workplace law, employment benefits, federal contract, employer compliance, employer law, faith-based employers, which really definitely applies to us. He's an adjunct professor with the University of Alabama School of Law, and Matt is consistently recognized as the best lawyer in America. And super lawyers. I was wondering, what are super lawyers?
They don't give us a cape.
No cape?
No capes or superpowers.
Okay, well, nothing for the shirt either. You know, okay. But it's included among the top 50 lawyers in Alabama since 2014. So we want to welcome you. We appreciate all the information that you've given us over the years, and we know it's going to be good again. So.
Thanks, Randy. Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you. I have had the privilege of working with faith-based nonprofits for my entire career, for about 20 years. I'm still a young lawyer, I think. I think that still qualifies me as a young lawyer. But I think this is a time that is more exciting, at least from my vantage point, looking at employment than ever before. And I think, you know, you have to look at excitement from when a lawyer says something's exciting. You guys should be a little bit wary of that, right? When you see that unemployment is at the lowest level that it's been since the 1950s, what that really means is that there are more people working today who don't want to be working than ever before. That's what that means. And we have a myriad number of employment laws that provide them with ways to be a thorn in the side of their employers when they don't want to be there. And so I say it's exciting. I think this is a very challenging employment environment. And I think that's especially true for our faith-based organizations, many of whom are organizations that are having generational change in the leadership roles right now. So many of our faith-based organizations really blossomed at a time, 25, 35, 45 years ago, when senior leadership is now looking to have an exit strategy. And I think that creates a void for our organizations in a number of ways in transitioning the mission. We have a workforce today. I would say that as many complaints as I've heard about millennials, right, and I hear a lot of them, the one thing that I consistently hear that's a positive is that our millennial workforce wants to do something they believe in. They want to do something they believe in. And so we've got a great selling point as employers because, boy, do we have a mission that people can believe in. So at the time that we're experiencing sort of on a national scale, on a macro scale, this changing of the guard, if you will, generational change in a lot of our organizations, we're having this new generation come along that is really inspired and wants to be inspired. And we've got a story to tell those new millennial workforce members. So we've got to tell our story, and yet this generation is coming up through a system of rules and misunderstandings of the rules, unlike no generation ever before, particularly as it relates to the rules of the workplace, notions of what is fair and what is not fair. That I think sometimes create what look like to outsiders a contradiction in the way that faith-based organizations operate. We're not to blame for this apparent contradiction. We've got a mission. The law allows us, authorizes us to fulfill our mission. But to the outside world, it could look like discrimination. It could look like discrimination. And so the segment that we have this morning is designed to talk about the exemptions from federal employment laws that apply to our types of organizations. But really, I think when we talk through this material this morning, what I'm really trying to emphasize to us is that we've got to think carefully about how we explain it. It's almost a session in PR on discrimination, because we as organizations, if we have a preference for hiring someone who follows our own faith-based beliefs, who is capable of witnessing and discipleship consistent with our funding sources, consistent with our mission, the law says that is not discrimination. It's not discrimination for us as a faith-based organization to have a preference for hiring and promoting individuals who adhere to our core philosophical and religious beliefs. It is not discrimination. And yet, I still see us frequently, as organizations with a faith-based mission, dance around this issue a little bit. Someone will send me a handbook to review, right? And the normal handbook policy for a typical employer, right up front, is going to say, we don't discriminate on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, age, disability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And I will see in a faith-based organization's handbook that religion's pulled out. So it says we don't discriminate on the basis of race, color, sex, national origin. They pulled religion out. Well, guess what? What are we telling people? We're going to discriminate on the basis of religion, right? And I think that's because we misunderstand what the federal laws of the workplace tell us. We are entitled under the law. It's in the statutes that we are entitled to make employment choices based on religion because of our faith-based status, because of our core mission. And so I want us to put that word back in there. We don't discriminate on the basis of religion. The law defines what discrimination is. And if you hang around with me to when we get to the third session of the day when I'm here, we're going to focus later today on just exactly how we should be dealing with a lot of these funding sources, third-party funding sources, whether it's federal or state grant money or contracts, insurance contracts, that try to contractually obligate us to something different than the law. They'll slip in there some sort of clause that says this organization is not going to discriminate on the basis of, and give a long list of these things. Well, unless it says unlawfully discriminate on the basis of such and such, they've created a different standard for us than the law. So that's what we'll be talking about in the third session, how we watch for that. And listen, the people who draft those contracts are not to blame for that. They don't understand it either. They don't understand it either. So this morning is intended to make sure that really we are communicating on these points correctly. We do not discriminate on the basis of religion. The statute authorizes us as faith-based organizations to have preferences for religion for a myriad number of reasons that are consistent with our mission. And that's really the overarching message for our time together this morning. And we'll talk about the tools in the toolbox to sort of help us navigate those waters. In the federal context, and I know that this organization is nationwide, we've had the chance to work together on a number of state law issues as well over the time that we've worked together. The focus this morning is on the federal law because it applies to all of us, and because most of the state laws, I can't speak for folks that live out west where Randy does, most of us, our state laws, they embrace the same concepts and the same exact elements of the federal laws. A few places like California, namely one of them, they don't care what the federal law says. They're going to make it up as they go along. So it's a little trickier out there. But otherwise, for the most part, all of our state laws, to the extent that you think that, that you've got one in your state that says something different, it tracks the same federal standards. And because the federal law has been out there so much longer, we have many, 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 many more court decisions interpreting those statutes that guide how we understand our obligations. And so really that's where the emphasis is on understanding how these rights work. The two statutes that are the most important to us under federal law, Title VII, Civil Rights Act of 1964, that's the one that's race, color, religion, sex, national origin. It's a very peculiar statute when we think about discrimination generally, because it's one of only two statutes that says not only are we barred from discriminating on the basis of these specified classes, but we must also accommodate reasonably one of them, but only one of them. It's the one we care the most about. It's religion. Title VII was the first one that said, not only do we not discriminate on this basis, but we have to accommodate religion. There's only one other federal non-discrimination statute that does that. That's the Disability, Americans with Disabilities Act. So Title VII is really the starting framework for our anti-discrimination laws. And because it was passed in a climate in 1964, when everyone was thinking about how will this affect a vast number of organizations that might have a legitimate basis for some preferences, the statute did a pretty darn good job in 1964 of saying, here are some exceptions to the general rule. And what everybody hears about is the general rule. They don't hear about these exceptions. So I think it's a valuable time for us to talk about it. The other piece is the FLSA. The FLSA, Fair Labor Standards Act, that's the federal wage and hour law. It's actually the oldest employment statute in America, Fair Labor Standards Act, unless you count like the Railway Transportation Safety Act. Oldest employment law in the country. It was passed as part of the New Deal, intended to set minimum wages, overtime requirements, try to establish a work week, those kinds of things. It's the only other statute that we regularly encounter in the federal environment that in some cases speaks to some unique aspects of being a faith-based employer. If, for example, we had to pay our head pastor minimum wage and overtime, the church would not be able to raise enough funds to cover, I think they squeeze more than 24 hours out of a day, right? How would we do that? So without a doubt, the FLSA also contains some exceptions applicable to us. So we've talked about these protected classes. I want to just give a quick overview. We talked about how race, color, religion, sex, national origin, these are the big five. They come from Title VII. Age Discrimination Employment Act, totally separate statute, right? No faith-based exemptions or specialties for us as it relates to age in the Age Discrimination Employment Act. Same thing with disability, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Again, unto itself, a separate statute from Title VII. USERRA, the Uniformed Services Employment Reemployment Rights Act, requires that we avoid discrimination against individuals due to their military service. In 1973, pregnancy was decided to be so intertwined with being female that Congress decided, I know why you're laughing, I'll come back to it. Congress decided that pregnancy was so intertwined with being a female that it was a type of Title VII sex discrimination to discriminate on the basis of pregnancy or pregnancy-related side effects. And so they amended Title VII to create the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. I think it is one of the most widely misunderstood statutes out there because it operates under a slightly different framework than Title VII. Title VII basically says we gotta treat similarly situated employees doing similar things similarly. And if we don't, which we're allowed to do, we must have legitimate business reasons for why we do what we do. That's all Title VII says. The Pregnancy Discrimination Act says that we have to treat a pregnant employee in our workplace at least as favorably as other workers who are similarly limited in their abilities or inabilities to work. That's kind of an odd standard. And it has evolved over time. We got our most recent ruling on the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Oh, I think it was right before the last time we got together, Danny. It was a case of Young versus UPS, and it's a reminder of how long some of these cases can go on. It was a case about a UPS driver who was pregnant, and UPS had, it had light duty for individuals who had lost their CDL, their over-the-road truck license, due to failing a physical, right? Federal truck drivers have to annually get a physical. They don't pass their physical. UPS would say, okay, we're going to put you on light duty. We're going to get you on a health plan, get you cleaned up, get you to pass your physical, and then you can get back to full duty, right? It also had a light duty for workers' comp. And so Peggy Young finds out she's pregnant. She's had 6 miscarriages in her life up to this point. She is, I think, 42 years old at the time, so already a high-risk pregnancy. Doctor says, this looks very good for you, Peggy, but you've got to reduce the stress on your body from being a UPS delivery driver. So she asks, can I get on light duty? UPS says, we've got light duty for these CDL folks, but you've passed your physical, so that's not available to you. We've got light duty for workers' comp, but you haven't had an on-the-job injury. At least I don't think pregnancy is an on-the-job injury. We might have to revisit that issue later. But they said, we don't have anything for you, Peggy. And you look at both of those policies, right? They're both written without regard for pregnancy. I mean, no one at UPS said, let's stick it to the pregnant workers by having this light duty for CDL people, or let's stick it to pregnant workers by having this workers' comp light duty. No, their insurance told them to do the workers' comp light duty. The Department of Transportation told them to do the CDL light duty. They weren't thinking about discriminating. So she files a lawsuit, and it goes through various different levels of appeal, and it gets to the U.S. Supreme Court. She brings, by the way, to the oral argument at the Supreme Court, her daughter, now 7 years old, for oral argument. Just a reminder that even when we think we're on solid ground, and UPS certainly did, these cases can be very expensive and very time-consuming. And so when I try to give advice about, you know, what the laws say, really what I'm thinking is, how do we avoid getting the claim? I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, this is winnable. It's another thing to say, what do we do to avoid the claim? Because think about it. If that was one of our small organizations, 7 years in litigation, it would wipe us out. It'd wipe us out. So the Supreme Court finally said, yes, Peggy, you should get the same access to light duty that a similarly situated non-pregnant worker would receive associated with similar restrictions on their ability or inability to work. It was the very first time that we ever got that rule. We'd been operating since 1973 on the notion that if the employer had a facially neutral light duty policy, they didn't have to give it to a pregnant worker. All of a sudden, 3 years ago, Supreme Court says, nope, not anymore. So even when we think we know the law, the courts continue to throw a curveball at us. So that's pregnancy, a little bit different than everything else, where that has really created some issues for us as organizations, as employers, is that we've got to think when, you know, a lot of times we used to say, well, we don't have FMLA. We're not big enough for FMLA, so we don't have FMLA leave, right? So we don't really have pregnancy leave. A lot of organizations said that. We just don't do it. Unless we're either big enough for FMLA or you become eligible for FMLA, we just don't do it. And now what we've got to say is, well, what have we done in the past for a non-pregnant worker who is similarly limited in his or her ability or inability to work? Some top fundraiser that we hired, right, and they get in a car accident, not a workers' comp case. They're in traction for 6 weeks. Did we hold the job for them? That would be an example, right? So we've got, it forces us to ask those questions that we didn't have to ask before. That's how we deal with pregnancy. So it has created some challenges for us. And again, I say, they decided it was so intermittently intertwined with being a female. Of course, now we see some rather bizarre news stories that tell us that it may not even necessarily be intertwined with being a female. Now we just think about it as pregnancy. And so when we even think about how we write these policies, we try to think about them in terms of pregnant persons and non-pregnant persons. The law is evolving in strange ways. Citizenship is a prohibited basis of discrimination. We ask everybody who comes to work for us to fill out an I-9, right? Which tells us whether they are authorized or not authorized to work in the United States. Citizenship is one way to establish you're authorized to work in the United States, but not a requirement. It can be established in other ways. And so we don't discriminate on the basis of citizenship. Genetic information was one that was passed in the waning years of the Bush administration. I haven't figured out yet how an employer could discriminate on the basis of genetic information. I don't have any clients that take DNA samples that I'm aware of. So if you figure out how to discriminate on this basis, let me know and we'll talk about it. But up till now, I think it's kind of a non-starter. Marital status, not a federal requirement. Some state laws will say we don't discriminate on the basis of marital status. It's a tricky one to figure out. In most instances, there are broad-based exceptions to that discrimination criteria. We won't get into that today because it's not a subject of federal law, but it's one to be mindful of if your state's one that prohibits it. Most of the time when you see a law prohibiting marital status discrimination, it is prohibiting discrimination by a governmental organization against a citizen employee on the basis of marital status, not private sector employers and employees. So I just wanted to knock that one out. And then these last two are the trend du jour, and they're working their way sort of eastward from the Western federal court systems. You know, we had a very quick pendulum swing in this country when there were state propositions passing state law ordinances that were making sure that these were not protected classes, and then in exactly one federal election cycle later, the exact propositions were going the opposite direction. Public opinion changing in the opposite direction. And so it started really with state legislatures and state propositions, but then the court system, which is so politicized now that I am truly convinced you can find a federal judge somewhere if you just shop for one long enough to say whatever you want one to say. It used to be you could say no judge would ever agree to this or that, or not anymore. In fact, when we talk about the new FLSA rules in the second session this morning, we will look at the ruling by a Texas federal judge, which overturned the Obama-era minimum salary requirements to qualify for an exemption. That judge was an appointee by President Obama. And yet, the plaintiff in that case was the state of Nevada. And you're going, why is the state of Nevada suing the federal government in the Eastern District of Texas? Why? Because they thought that was the best place to file a suit where a judge would overturn it. And they got the only Obama appointee on that court, and he gave them exactly what they thought they would get. Overturn the statute. You can find a judge anywhere to say anything. But sexual orientation and gender identity are being interpreted by the courts, sort of like pregnancy fell out of sex under Title VII. The federal courts are saying sexual orientation and gender identity are so intertwined with sex that we think it's a type of Title VII discrimination to discriminate on the basis of those two things. Now, for faith-based organizations that are passionate about these two issues or view those two issues as conflicting with their mission, that is really, really good news for you that they believe that these roll up under Title VII. Because remember, Title VII is the only one that expressly gives us religious protection. So if that's the law, and if you're an organization that has concerns about those things conflicting with your mission, this is actually good news for you that that's how this law is finding its way onto the books. The other way is by these legislative enactments. And there have been federal attempts to create a unique standalone statute protecting these two classes for quite some time. There's one that was just voted out of committee in the House last month that you know, will get some traction in the House. I suspect it's dead on arrival in the Senate. But these efforts will continue, and I think we've got to watch them very closely if you are a faith-based organization that says those two issues create some problems for us. We would much rather that if those two are going to be declared as protected classes, that they do so through a Title VII avenue rather than through their own statute, where we are less likely to get religious protections. So really two big picture questions that we should be thinking about when we think about these statutes. The first is, does the statute give us a statutory express exemption that applies uniquely to us because of what we do? And when we look at some of these, we will see they get a little bit granular. The courts tend to construe the exemptions very narrowly. And so there are some organizations that may not be faith-based enough to qualify for the express exemptions in the statute. But yet there are a number of tools in the toolbox, and the best tool available to us in the toolbox, particularly as it relates to the non-discrimination statutes, is what we call the BFOQ, the Bona Fide Occupational Qualification. We talked about the BFOQs a good bit the last time we were able to get together, about 2 years ago down in Texas, I believe it was, Sherry, with your organization hosting. The BFOQ is really where I tend to put the bulk of my emphasis on how we should conduct ourselves with regard to these exemptions. And the reason is that the BFOQ applies across the board. It's not a statutory creation. It's a judicially created doctrine that says that an employer does not discriminate in violation of one of the statutes where it can establish that it has a bona fide occupational qualification that dictates a particular protected class or exemption of the protected class, particular sex, particular ethnicity, a particular national origin. The judicial created doctrine says places like Chinese restaurants have as much in common with the church as they've ever had before. Because the Chinese restaurant is saying, our mission as a Chinese restaurant is to create the most authentic dining experience we can provide. And for that reason, it is a bona fide occupational qualification that our servers, our front of the house staff, are all Asian. We've decorated this place from floor to ceiling in Asian, Chinese, whatever it might be, in our theme. Our people are part of delivering that authentic dining experience. The church and the Chinese restaurant, the church, and here's the kicker. Are you ready for this one? Hooters. The church and Hooters restaurants submitted briefs to the courts arguing for the same issues. Hooters restaurant's argument is, we're trying to deliver a particular experience. We can't deliver that experience if Matt Stiles wears a halter top and short shorts. We can't do it. That's their argument, right?
Matt,
yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've told that story. And it works.
It's a little embarrassing. It's a little embarrassing to talk about. I'm sure that when the church submitted, many churches submitted briefs in those cases, arguing on behalf of Hooters. Because the BFOQ is a generally applicable rule. It's not an exception unique to the church. It is a broadly applicable, judicially created doctrine that explains to us how the discrimination statutes work in the real world. And if we as a faith-based employer have something in common with a whole host of other employers who have legitimate reasons for preferences, then we're on much more solid ground than relying on a judge somewhere to say this exemption written in the statute that was intended in 1964 to help churches applies to us. Churches are not, they don't look anything like what they looked like in 1964. They are supporting their mission in such a multitude of ways that was never envisioned in 1964. And so the BFOQ as a judicial doctrine that evolves over time is viewed as much better for us than relying on a 1964 statute. And so that's why I put both of these up there. And I'll tell you, when we get to the FLSA argument, I've had the privilege of representing a couple of your agencies who received DOL wage and hour audits focused on house parents. And the way that we fought those audits was with every tool in the toolbox. I pulled out the bazooka. And so that DOL auditor heard from me on the United States Constitution's clauses that deal with accommodations for religion, all the way down to the most granular exemptions in the statute, including all of them that would apply to something that isn't a faith-based organization. And so we assert every single one of those, and by the time that auditor is done reading that 7-page treatise on why this law doesn't apply to us, their head is spinning. And they close their audits. And they walk away. Because it would take too many different levels of approval to go after a faith-based organization on a federal audit level. So they both went away. So we're going to use all the tools in the toolbox if we have to use them. So they're all important to us. But the one I really want us thinking the most about is the BFOQ. Let's start with the general exemptions. I've touched on the BFOQ a good bit. But remember, one of these that's important to us is that Title VII doesn't even apply to us unless we employ 15 employees. Does that mean that organizations with 14 or fewer employees can discriminate on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin? Yes, it actually does. It actually does. Those are believed to be such closely held organizations, such small organizations in character, that the owner-operators of those businesses should be able to make decisions more freely without being subject to federal law. It seems odd. I still, on occasion, will get an EEOC charge that comes in against a client that does not have 15 or more. And my normal way of responding to that, because even the EEOC thinks it's almost incredulous that an organization of 14 or fewer employees can discriminate at will. So what we'll do is we'll answer that EEOC charge by saying, by golly, we did not discriminate. Because we really don't want to discriminate. Nobody wants to use an impermissible basis to make a business decision. I really never see my clients engage in discrimination. I see harassment. I see people get away with harassment from time to time. But I almost never see unlawful discrimination occur. And so we'll answer that EEOC charge by saying, here's what happened. Here's where there's a misunderstanding. We didn't discriminate. But, oh, by the way, we're not even subject to your statute. And I think because we answer on both counts, they go away. I think that's what makes them go away. If we just said we didn't discriminate because we don't have 15 employees or more, what we're going to get in response to that is a 400-item questionnaire to establish how many employees we've ever had, when we last had them. Let me see your books. Let me see all your tax filings. You know what I mean? They're going to bludgeon you about that exception. So it's not a blank check to discriminate. It's an old statutory exception. We want to think about, we want to assert. And note that we say here, listen, it's 15 employees of any kind, right? It's 15 employees of any kind, any classification. But it still matters. EEOC has no jurisdiction without 15 employees or more. Here is the BFOQ and how it works. What you need for the job must be a bona fide occupational qualification reasonably necessary to the normal operation of that particular business or enterprise. And there are regulations here. That's what you've got interpreting the BFOQ. on top of a statutory statement that just generally gives you that reasonably necessary to the normal operation of that particular business or enterprise. That's what gets interpreted by the courts over and over and over again. Again, it's available to any employer, not just our faith-based organizations. Courts continue to narrowly construe it, but because they construe it for so many organizations, we've got a lot of law to go on, right? We get to compare ourselves to the Chinese restaurant when there was less pressure on the judge to make that decision, right? So they had maybe a less scrutinizing decision that went in favor of the Chinese restaurant. We get to use it every time because we're relying on the same exemption. We've got to show in the religious context that religion plays an extremely important part, and that's from the court decisions, extremely important part of the work environment, and it's applicable to the job or the jobs at issue. This is one of those areas where we go back to the Chinese restaurant example for me for a minute, because in some ways it's an easier example. You and your family decide to go have an authentic Chinese dining experience. You go to the front door, you're greeted by a host, hostess, maitre d', who is going to look authentically Chinese or Asian, right? Makes sense to us, makes sense to the business that the person who greets you at the door presents that image. You're going to sit down at your table, and the person who comes over to take your order, probably going to be someone authentic, makes sense to the business that that's an authentic Asian person. The kitchen is over here on the left, and someone's rolling sushi, right? And they're making the meal right there as you watch. Not like a Japanese steakhouse, but, you know, an open kitchen. Makes sense that everybody in that kitchen also looks, appears Asian as part of that authentic dining experience. The minute that we take that kitchen and it's behind two swinging doors somewhere in the back, does it matter? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Our food comes out, we have a great meal, we compliment the chef, we head home, the restaurant closes, people come in and they start cleaning up tables. Does it matter to the restaurant's mission whether those folks appear to be authentically Chinese or Asian? No, it doesn't. So same factors are at play here for using the BFOQ for the faith-based mission. We've got people who work on our premises who probably interact with the people we're delivering a mission to. And so on a scale, there's a degree of importance to whether they adhere to our faith-based mission. But how important is it the further away you get from the people we serve? And the courts will apply that standard. They will say, the less likely that this person is part of fulfilling the faith-based mission, the less likely you can assert it. And that's all part of how the BFOQ is assessed. The further away we get from it, the less likely you can use it. And so we've got the issue of the degree of removal from the mission is one of them. But I want to go back to the big piece up here, this extremely important part of the mission. A lot of our organizations at various different times in their history have sought either with their documents or otherwise to take a step back, maybe deliberately, maybe not deliberately, from their faith-based origins. Maybe they were trying to appeal to a particular private a funding source or a third-party funding source. And so they toned down the religious mission statement in their handbooks and on their websites. And they removed those references in their articles of incorporation. It is extremely important that if we're going to assert our faith-based mission, that it is demonstrably, objectively at the center of what we do. And so everything that we create as a legal entity that talks about who we are or what we do has got to emphasize the extreme importance of the faith-based mission, right down to our articles of incorporation, right down to when we have our board meetings, Our minutes should reflect every time we meet as a board our discussion of our faith-based mission. Our handbooks, our websites, our intranet sites, our performance appraisals, our job descriptions. A lot of organizations said, we're too small. Job descriptions are such a burden, we're not going to have them. If you don't have them, don't expect to be able to use the BFOQ for them. Because the first question will be, what's the essential function of this employee's job? Tell me how it's connected to the faith-based mission. And if all it is your word of, here's what I expected that they would do, but you can't show that it's in their job description and that they're evaluated on it on a regular basis, some court somewhere has the ability to second-guess your assertion of the faith-based mission for that employee. So we've got to be constantly thinking about how we emphasize the extreme importance, because these general exemptions are the best pathway to going forward. Yeah, Sherry.
So would you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but would
yeah.
you...
Please interrupt.
Would you give us some examples of like how that would be evaluated on a regular basis? Like, is that, you take attendance on whether or not they're going to church, or is it they're leading, I mean, just give us some examples of how that would be evaluated.
Yeah, I mean, your mission, I like to tie everything back to a mission statement or a core belief statement, right? And so what I would do first of all, I would put in every job description what each employee's responsibility is in relation to our mission or our core beliefs. Whatever those expectations are, and they could be as granular as you're going to abstain from the consumption of alcohol. You're going to be a faithful spouse to your spouse. You're going to be a role model and steward of the faith to your own children and to the children that are in your care. So I'd want it in the job description. And then each time I do a performance appraisal, I'd want to go back to the job description and track, what have you done demonstrably to fulfill this part of your expectations? And I'd ask the employee, tell me how you would account for it. I always, and as part of every performance management, Sherry, I like to hear from the employee first. So I'm going to give them the performance appraisal. I'm going to ask them, how do you believe you've demonstrated your compliance with these expectations? I'm going to review that, and then I'm going to meet with them that discusses my perceptions of it compared to their perceptions of it. But to the extent we're creating forms for these things, it should absolutely track the core beliefs or the mission, how they're tied into the job description, and what the individual employee has done in fulfillment of those missions. And sometimes they're going to be very general in nature. You know, I've been a disciple for Christ this year. Here are the things that I've done in that capacity. Maybe there are things that are specific to job functions, but maybe there are things away from work that are part of fulfilling that mission. Showing that you are a believer in our faith and in our mission by your actions away from work are just as important as what you do at work. So I think you can go down that list in a number of ways that each and every one of us lives our life for Christ. So I think that's how I would do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in addition to that, and here again, I'm trying to look at the picture. So as an agency is growing and you hire employees, and I completely understand your description of the Chinese Asian restaurant thing. We don't have walls in our office necessarily.
That's right.
So certain positions, say the accountant or the physical plant manager or whatever, how do you know who falls into that one category that separates them from like a case manager or somebody who interacts daily with the kids we serve? Like I say, I'm a little confused on, for us, I think that's a little more fuzzy. Maybe.
It's going to be. I mean, I think you almost have to think of jobs as being on a faith-based spectrum, right? And on one hand, we've got clergy. Right, and on another hand, we've got someone who could do their job all day long without even knowing what our mission is. And there are going to be those folks. There simply will be. You're right that there are rarely walls in between them.
I just didn't know how to distinct.
You have to, it's a challenge. It's a really tough challenge. You have to look at the content of that job. And it might be that you, if you find yourself looking at a job description for that job, which I think forces us to have a certain degree of scrutiny on where that job falls on the spectrum, I think the job description forces us to put in writing what our expectations are, and I think it helps us figure out where we're talking about on that spectrum. If we find ourselves laboring to connect this job to the faith-based mission, we're in trouble. It's got to pass the smell test that this is someone who's fulfilling our mission. And the fact of the matter is, the further away that we get on that spectrum under the general rule, this BFOQ rule, the further we are away from anything on the statutory exceptions we'll look at in a minute. I mean, those statutory exceptions are almost out the door for us if we can't satisfy, because the BFOQ is the easier standard. It's the easier standard. Yeah.
But
this is a confusing topic.
It is very much so. So I'm in the South, so let's start by that. So I feel like, you know, it's always in Georgia for sure, with the environment politically right now where we're in. So when I think about the positions that I have, and it is in our mission statement that we offer Christian compassionate services. However, we're also up against other non-faith-based organizations doing exactly the same work. And we have a lot of restrictions on our ability to, like, force children to go to church and different things of that nature. So how, when you kind of line that up with an organization that's saying, okay, you do the exact same work, you have the exact same audit that another organization has that's non-faith-based, how do you, like, almost justify that?
You have to take your faith-based mission and try to put it into the objective metrics by which you judge yourself, for starters. You can say that a third party or an auditor or a funding agency only evaluates on these six metrics, and they evaluate me the same way they evaluate the non-faith-based down the road doing the same thing. That won't matter if the way you evaluate yourself incorporates the faith-based metrics. Okay? I know that's tricky, right? I know that's tricky. Danny?
You helped Agape to formalize our statement of faith and our code of conduct. Instead of going through and listing each one of those behaviors out, would it be acceptable for us in our annual reviews to just ask the question, even in a discussion form at the end of the review, does this employee continue to live by and in accordance with that statement of faith and that kind of thing, instead of listing out 500 things ranging from spitting on the sidewalk to carrying a gun to work?
Yeah, Danny's question is, can we evaluate our employees annually on a single question, a general question of how they have followed our mission or adhered to the faith, without getting granular? And absolutely, you can. I just gave getting granular as an example. You can get as granular as you want to get, right? You can also be general if you want to be general about it. The key is, does the general question and the way that we handle it and the way we evaluate it, does it demonstrate the extreme importance to the organization that faith-based mission plays and how it affects that job? If it does, you've checked the box on the document. And that's really what I'm getting at. I mean, I know we all work towards those goals individually and as a group, but how do we document it in an objective way that helps prove it to the court?
So for a simple-minded guy like me, what you're saying is the more religious we become, the better off we are.
Absolutely. If you want to use the faith-based exemptions and the bona fide occupation, if you want to use them, if you want them there to protect you, the more faith-based you are, the more overwhelmingly faith-based you are, the better, without a doubt.
So, not to, maybe this is a... So one of the things that, I don't know if you've mentioned it before or not, there's this ecclesiastical authority. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that? Because we're churches of Christ. So there's no, you know, there's no Southern Baptist convention. There's no Presbyterian. You know, there's none of that. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Ecclesiastical authority.
It does not matter how big the infrastructure of your faith-based organization is in the background. How big it is, how well known it is. It really is specific, because when you look at the exemption, it's specific to the job and to the employer, not to where it derives its mission. And so, you know, that doesn't matter at all. I mean, the fact that you get funding from, some sort of faith-based organization, whether it's a church even, really doesn't affect your ability to declare the BFOQ or to be a faith-based nonprofit. None of that does. Does it help? Sure. Because what we have to do to declare these exemptions and use them is we have to educate someone on why we're entitled to them. And the more that it sounds familiar to them, the easier it is to prove it, right? I mean, I see these ridiculous cases about religious accommodation all the time, right? And the one that jumps out at me is a Title VII case from about 15 years ago. It involved a Costco store and an employee who had defaced her body with piercings and tattoos and cutting and horrendous things. And declared that she was entitled to accommodation under Title VII because she was a member of the Church of Body Modification. And, you know, courts generally don't like to weigh in on what is a legitimate or an illegitimate religion. They don't like to say, that's absurd, right? I mean, if we polled each other in this room, I'm pretty sure we would all agree that was a joke of a claim, right? That's not a real church. It's not a real faith. We would all deny that that's a real faith. We would all say it. But a court doesn't want to say it. Court doesn't like to say it. And yet, the more unfamiliar that it is, the greater the scrutiny the court is going to put on the other aspects of your claim. So it helps us to be able to say, oh, we've got the backing of this particular church or this group of churches. That helps us, because then the judge or whoever's asked to interpret it goes, oh yeah, them, right? But that's really where it stops. That's really where it stops for us, because the courts just don't want to delve into, is this a really well-established one or not? Is this one we should embrace or not? They're going to get past that pretty quickly and see, how has whatever religious backing you've got, how has whatever your religious purpose is, how has it manifested itself in your organization as an employer, not what's the legitimacy behind it. So those are the things I really want at the forefront of how we work to declare our faith-based exemptions. This is the most important one. Now, Title VII does have a general religious exception that it calls. It's baked into the statute. And it says that the prohibition against religious discrimination does not apply to a religious corporation, association, educational institution, society, with respect to the employment of individuals of a particular religion to perform work connected with the carrying on by such entity of its activities. What does that sound like to you? Sounds a lot like the BFOQ, doesn't it? Just applied to a religious organization? It really is. However, if all we did was try to hang our hat on this particular statutory exception, the court's entire focus is going to be on, well, are we a religious corporation? And how is that defined? Are we an educational institution? And how is that defined? And they have narrow definitions for each and every one of these, because they're derived from statute that didn't explain it. So all of the entities that trigger this exception are not defined. And you would almost think of them as being on the same spectrum. And in effect, what happens is that the courts, because they don't know how to interpret this exception, they end up applying the BFOQ. I mean, look down here at what the courts use to analyze this religious exception. What's the purpose of the mission of the organization? BFOQ. What's the ownership, affiliation, or source of funding for the org? Alright, so maybe that's a little bit outside the BFOQ. What are the requirements placed on staff and members of the organization, including faculty and students if it's a school? Again, how do you make the employee embrace the mission? And then four, what's the extent of the religious practices in or the religious nature of products and services offered by the organization? How is the faith-based mission part of what you do? It almost tracks to a T the BFOQ, but it only applies to the religious entity, and so it gets more scrutiny from the courts. So I basically say, listen, go with the BFOQ instead. Go with the BFOQ instead. There's another one baked into the statute under Title VII that lets religious educational institutions hire and employ employees of a particular religion. Again, you got these qualifiers on it. Substantial part owned, supported, controlled, or managed by a particular religion or by a particular organization if the curriculum of the institution is directed toward the propagation of a particular religion. And when they look at this, they really parse out what constitutes an educational institution. And they ask questions like, is it accredited? Is it accredited? If it's not accredited, they say not a religious educational institution, no matter how much religion you might be teaching as part of your existence. Again, the BFOQ would be a better defense for you than this one. Yet they seem to sort of track some of the same concepts. So if we're defending ourselves in court, you bet we're going to raise both of the statutory exceptions and then the general BFOQ. But the court's going to evaluate us on the BFOQ. That's what it's going to do. Again, these are limited to hiring and firing decisions. They wouldn't necessarily be there to protect us in terms of promotional decisions or discipline-based decisions. So even the exceptions themselves aren't that great. One of my favorite exceptions, the one I raise every chance I get to talk to one of these agencies or to a court about how these laws apply to faith-based organizations, is the Constitution's Free Exercise Clause, which is the basis for why they drafted the original religious exceptions in Title VII. One of my favorite ones that has been developed by the courts. Again, it's separate from statute. Everything that gets interpreted under the Constitution is just interpreted by a court. It's not a statute. And so it's common law, and it's evolving, and it's elastic, and it can be almost as good for us as it can be bad for us if the popular trend in the courts swings a particular way. But one thing that's been fixed in the courts for quite some time is this ministerial exception. The more that we can show that our employees are engaged in ministering the faith, the more that we can declare the ministerial exception. And it's derived specifically from the Constitution's Free Exercise Clause. And so you'll see the courts looking at the ministerial exception. Some of them will apply them, for example, as far down the line from pastor to something right in here in the middle where maybe we've got school teacher, faith-based organization school teacher. I would say that that's pretty darn close to a house parent in a lot of our organizations. These are folks who are leading the family unit, who are the faith-based leader of the family unit. I think that's a pretty good analogy. We have raised the ministerial exception for house parents successfully in the past, which means that if the Constitution prohibits it, we don't even get into any of these other statutes, right? We don't even get there. We start with the Constitution because Congress can't pass a law that abridges the constitutional right to free expression of religion. So I like how that one works as well. We assert that quite often. I still say, if you are working towards establishing your BFOQ, this will also be an argument for you. But the BFOQ gives us the better framework to operate on. So we've talked about the BFOQ. We've talked about making sure that our core mission is expressed throughout the organization. I'm going to skip the BFOQ slide. Let's talk about the FLSA here. Fair Labor Standards Act. The coverage under the Fair Labor Standards Act is one of the most misunderstood statutory coverage clauses of all the laws that we look at. And that's because it deals with two ways that an employer can become covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. The first is enterprise coverage. You as a business entity, even though you're nonprofit, you as a business entity can be covered for all of your employees if you are an enterprise under the eyes of the government. And they typically say, and this is a guidance that they issued when the Obama administration proposed the last go-round of the increase to the minimum salary. Obama administration said, as a general matter, nonprofit organizations are not covered enterprises under the FLSA unless they engage in ordinary commercial activities that result in sales made or business done that meets the $500,000 annual threshold. That $500,000 is gross receipts. And what worries me here is that so many of our faith-based and nonprofits engage in business activities to generate additional revenue. I know that one of the things that's been very popular for our groups have been thrift stores. Thrift stores would be an example of a business enterprise. If your gross receipts, including that business activity, are $500,000 or more, then this general rule that a nonprofit is not a covered enterprise is out the door for you because you're engaged in a business activity with competitors. There's even been an argument in some of these house parent lawsuits that because there are both for-profit and non-profit, faith-based and not faith-based entities that compete for state dollars to fund our foster agencies and group homes, that even that is a business enterprise. I think those cases have gotten it wrong. They were never appealed. They were low-level court decisions, but there's a risk there. So we should think critically about our charitable activities versus our business activities. And I've even worked with a couple of our organizations here to say, you know, let's think about separating the two structurally. Let's create 501c3, the thrift store over here, and maybe there's some commonalities among the board so that we retain some control. Maybe we lease them the land at $1 a year in exchange for donations, right? For a donation stream. But we divorce ourselves from our true faith-based mission from our business activities by creating formal legal structures that separate them. We've worked together to do that to avoid some of these issues. So the first thought is, are we engaged in some business activities or are we strictly generating donations? If we're generating donations, those generally are not going to count as business activities. Otherwise, we risk enterprise coverage. And again, the notion of enterprise coverage is sort of like the minimum employee number. If you have the minimum number of employees, the whole organization is covered. If you do the $500,000 in gross receipts, you are a covered enterprise for the FLSA. However, if you don't have the $500,000 in gross receipts, it's possible that individual employees within your organization could become covered by the FLSA by virtue of being engaged in interstate commerce. And the cases that we've seen most often dealing with organizations like ours, this is the angle that they take. They say, well, you know, you're driving kids across state lines, you're getting referrals across state lines, you're engaged in interstate commerce, or at least with those employees you are, and so we're going to attach FLSA obligations with those employees. And so you would not be a covered enterprise, but with regard to that group of employees, you would have to comply with the Fair Labor Standards Act. So a few ideas there for how we try to avoid individual coverage under the FLSA. We've talked about the ministerial exemption already. Wage and Hour embraces that notion themselves, saying that the minimum wage and overtime rules do not apply to individuals who qualify for the ministerial exemption. We've used that, again, as far down the line on the spectrum as house parents and had success getting DOL to go away. This is some Amtrak size font. So I'm going to ask maybe that if you don't have... Do you guys have access to these slides? Do you all have access? Yeah. Please share them with whom... Yes. This is how we currently analyze the house parent exemption. And I think for years, organizations like ours who have house parents have thought, oh, there is a specific exemption in Section 213B24 called the house parent exemption, that must apply to me. And the courts have generally said they don't, that it does not apply to us. And the reason is that in order to get it, you have to be an educationally qualified institution with on-campus living in a house parent setting. And the children that you provide care for have to be orphans, meaning without a living parent, which rarely is the case anymore. So increasingly, I'm seeing 213b-24 does not apply to the types of organizations that we have today. There have been a number of lobbying efforts to get Congress to fix this exemption to apply to the types of organizations that do this work today. Congress hasn't gotten around to touching it. However, there is guidance and regulations for house parent-like employees baked into the FLSA that really works for us. In essence, it says as long as we can follow a small group of rules about how these folks get paid for both regular house parents and relief parents, as long as we enter into a reasonable agreement with those house parents and relief parents that states the framework for what's compensable and what's not, DOL will not question our reasonable agreement. When we have had the chance to go off with DOL on this issue, they have given it to us every time that we've had a reasonable agreement with the house parent. Every time. And so I really think it is this rule here, which comes from a DOL opinion letter from 2004, applying an old regulation that was not really intended for house parents. This is the best way for us to comply as it relates to house parents in the FLSA. Not an exception, but an exemption that's effectively carved out. So I think we've talked on all the best practices. And I know I'm at the end of my time. You're waving me down. You're saying we got to let these guys go to the next session. These are the best practices, and this is what we'll end on. We'll get a chance to talk about some of these in the third session this morning. Number one, when we get questions about personnel matters, and we'll get them from various different sources, we do not comment on confidential personnel matters, period. We don't do it. We don't comment to third parties. We don't comment to funding sources. Those are confidential matters, and we keep those to ourselves. As it relates to discrimination, we comply with all applicable employment non-discrimination, all applicable non-discrimination laws. We comply with them all because there's an exception for us in what we do and the way we do it under every one of them. So we do not unlawfully discriminate. We do not unlawfully discriminate. And I would look for opportunities to declare that and to list in our protected class groups the ones that we don't discriminate on, to always list religion as a basis that we don't discriminate on. Because we do not unlawfully discriminate on the basis of those. Questions? I'll hang around. I know you guys need to get to the next session. I'm talking about the FLSA's new overtime exemption rules in the next session. Hope you'll join me.